Audio Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2013. This is issue number 343, and I'm your host, Fred Vobey. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. Those are the only emails, telephone numbers, and addresses to use to contact us here at the DX Audio Service. A yearly subscription for the DX Audio Service to U.S. Canadian members is now $30. The magazine is now published on CDs. And to subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated. And send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Well, before we get on with this edition of the DX Audio Service, we start out with a retraction. On a past edition of the DX Audio Service, we mentioned that we lost a member by the name of C.J. Brown. As it turns out, the post office lost him. We received a letter from C.J. saying, "Yes, I am amongst the living and still interested in the DX Audio Service," but it seemed that the post office, for some reason, had him as deceased. So welcome back, CJ. We're glad you're sticking around with us here on the DX Audio Service. Now here's Dave Alpert with a look at the August edition of the AM Switch.
Welcome to the pre-convention issue of the AM Switch, volume 80, number 28, starting off, as usual, with call letter changes, first from existing stations, 770 WWCN, North Fort Myers, Florida, changes its call to WJBX, 1010 WFGW, Black Mountain, North Carolina, is now WLYT, 1250 WNEM, Bridgeport, Michigan, changes calls to WHHQ, which stands for Hail Holy Queen. They've now adopted a Catholic format. 1400 WLSB, Copper Hill, Tennessee, call change to WLYY. And 1550 WLFP, Braddock, Pennsylvania, is now WZUM. Call sign changes for new station construction permits include the station on 830 in Grants Pass, Oregon. Assigned the call letters KBLN. New station CPs now on the air, 980 KMIN, Grants, New Mexico. Their construction permit for U1, 5,000 watts day, 230 watts night from a new site is now operating. 1330 KTON, Cameron, Texas, applies for license to cover CP for U4, 2,400 watts day, 130 at night from a new site. 1380 KRKO, Everett, Washington, CP for U2, 34,000 watts day, 5,000 watts night, is on the air. 1460 WQXM, Bartow, Florida, construction permit for U5, 10,000 watts day, 155 watts night, is now on. And 1520 KKXA, Snohomish, Washington, CP for U6, 50,000 watts day and night, is on the air. Construction permits granted for new stations. 1190 Red Hook, North Carolina, granted a CP for U2, 9,200 watts day, a kilowatt at night. 1310 in Anchorage, Alaska, CP granted for a new station with U1, 10,000 watts day, 8,100 at night. And 1360 Santa Maria, California, has a CP for a new station with U4, 2,000 watts day and night. They've actually been granted a modification of a CP for U2 650 watts day 500 night on 1380, which expires August 18th. Construction permits granted for existing stations. 730 WZGV, Cramerton, North Carolina, has a CP for U1, 10,000 watts day, 170 at night. They've been granted a modification of that to U1, 10,000 watts day, 165 at night, lowering the nighttime power. 940 WCPC, Houston, Mississippi, granted a construction permit for U4, 31,000 watts day, 7 watts at night, using the same two-tower pattern day and night from their existing site. 1010 WLYT, Black Mountain, North Carolina, granted a CP for U1, 47,000 watts day, 90 at night from a new site. 1290 WTKS, Savannah, Georgia, granted CP for U2, 5,300 watts day, 5 kilowatts night with a new night pattern from their existing site. 1360 WELR, Roanoke, Alabama, granted a CP for a new transmitter site, remaining U1, 1,000 watts day, 54 watts night. 1450 WBVA, Bayside, Virginia, granted a construction permit to move to a new site, remaining U1, 1,000 watts, day and night. 1470 WMGG, Dunedin, Florida, granted CP for U4, 2,800 watts day, 800 watts night. City of License moves to Egypt Lake, Florida, and they'll be transmitting from a new site replacing an expired CP. 1550 WVAB, Virginia Beach, Virginia, granted a CP for U1, 4,500 watts day, 8 watts night from a new transmitter site. And 1590 WCGO, Evanston, Illinois, has a CP for U2, 7,200 watts day, 2,000 watts night. They've been granted a modification of that CP to stay at U2, 7,200 watts day, 2,500 at night, but with a modified pattern. Applications for construction permits, 810 WRSO, Orla Vista, Florida, has an application for U4, 10,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night, now amending that application to U4, 20,000 watts day, and a kilowatt at night. 1110 WTIS, Tampa, Florida, applies for 10,000 watts day, 150 at night on 1100 from their existing transmitter site. 1150 WSNW, Seneca, South Carolina, applies for U1, 5,000 watts day, 58 at night. 1210 KGYN, Guymon, Oklahoma, applies for U7, 50,000 watts day, 10,000 watts night. 1400 WFLL, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, applies for permission to move to a new site, remaining 1,000 watts day and night. And 1410 WMSX, Brockton, Massachusetts, applies for U1, 610 watts day, 25 at night, changing their city of license to Dedham, Massachusetts, and operating from a new transmitter site. Auxiliary transmitters, 1000 WMVP, Chicago, Illinois, has been granted a CP for an auxiliary transmitter, D1, 12,000 watts, from an alternate site. We have these reports of CPs expiring and applications dismissed. 540 WXNH, Jaffrey, New Hampshire, a CP for a new station expired years ago but was subject to appeal. Now it's finally been deleted from the FCC database. 1020 in Chickasaw, Alabama, the application has been dismissed for a new station with U2, 10,000 watts day, 250 at night. The CP for a new station on 1030 in La Grande, Oregon, has expired, and that's now been deleted. Same for 1230 Milani Town, Hawaii, 1310 Bakersfield, California, and 1330 Porterville, California. Also, applications for new stations in Blanchard, Louisiana, and Tyler, Texas, have been dismissed. Moving on to existing stations, 560 WQAM, Miami, Florida. Their CP for U4 30,000 watts day, 2,500 watt night, has expired and has been deleted. WQAM remains U1, 5 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night. 790 WPNN, Pensacola, Florida. Their CP for D3, 3,000 watts on 780, has expired and been deleted. WPNN remains on 790 with U1, 1,000 watts day, 66 watts night. 1140 KZMQ, Grayville, Wyoming. Their CP for a change of city of license to 10 Sleep, Wyoming, has been deleted from the FCC database. 1280 KFRN, Long Beach, California. An application for U4, 500 watts day, 400 watts night, has been dismissed. 1340 KRLV, Las Vegas, Nevada, CP for U1, 1,000 watts day, 900 night from a new site, revoked at licensee's request. They've applied for U1, 1,000 watts day, 920 watts night from another new site. 1490 WSFB, Quitman, Georgia, CP for new transmitter site has expired and has been deleted. And WDEP, Ponce, Puerto Rico's CP for U1, 5,000 watts day, 1,400 watts night from a new site, has expired and been deleted. WDEP stays U1, 5 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night. Special Temporary Authority, 590 KSUB, Cedar City, Utah, granted an STA of U1, 5,000 watts day, 250 at night. The station has major issues with their grounding system and says it'll take a while to fix. 750 KXTG, Portland, Oregon, granted an STA for U4, 12,500 watts day, 20,000 watts night for tower painting. 850 KICY, Nome, Alaska, granted an STA for operating at reduced power during non-directional hours to save energy. WEEI in Boston, Massachusetts, has been granted an STA to operate with their antenna pattern out of tolerance during testing of new pattern monitoring equipment. 900 KTIS, Minneapolis, Minnesota, granted special temporary authority for U4, 39,500 watts day, 500 at night due to transmitter problems. 1020 KCKN, Roswell, New Mexico, previously granted STA for 10,000 watts, 24 hours a day, using an auxiliary transmitter, now granted STA with U1, 1,000 watts day and night, due to auxiliary transmitter problems. 1030 WNVR, Vernon Hills, Illinois, granted an STA for operating with pattern out of tolerance. 1160 WOBM, Lakewood Township, New Jersey, granted STA to operate with their pattern at variance or at reduced power. They're having problems maintaining their directional pattern. 1240 KRAL, Rollins, Wyoming, granted special temporary authority to use an emergency long wire antenna. The formerly silent station has lost its tower and needed to return to the air to maintain their license. 1260 KLYC, McMinnville, Oregon, granted STA for U1, 1,000 watts day, 212 watts night during antenna repairs. 1350 KRNT, Des Moines, Iowa, granted STA to have night pattern out of tolerance if necessary. Their antenna monitor was destroyed by lightning. 1380 WKJV, Asheville, North Carolina, granted an STA because of their grounding system copper getting stolen. 1410 WIHM, Taylorville, Illinois, granted an STA for U1, 250 watts day, 63 at night. Their directional antenna equipment failed over the weekend of June 1st. 1470 KWSL, Sioux City, Iowa, granted STA for U3, 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts at night, using the day pattern, 24 hours. Their antenna control system failed, meaning they can't switch to the night mode. 1520 KFXZ, Lafayette, Louisiana, granted SDA for U4, 1,000 watts day, 500 at night due to transmitter problems. 1570 KVTK, Vermilion, South Dakota, granted STA for U1, 695 watts day, 71 at night, operating from an emergency long wire antenna after their tower collapsed on June 10th. Silent STAs. These stations are going silent. 860 WAMI, Op, Alabama. They applied for a silent STA on June 6th. 960 WQLA, La Follette, Tennessee, off the air as of June 25th due to unpaid bills. 1150 KDEF, Albuquerque, New Mexico, applies for silent STA after losing their transmitter site. 1240 KRAL, Rollins, Wyoming, which we a moment ago mentioned had returned to the air, operating under an STA in order to maintain their license. They've gone silent again as of June 8th to resolve personnel and equipment issues. KTHE in Thermopolis, Wyoming, applies for a silent STA. They've been off the air since May 20th. 1280 KFAU, Gardner, Maine, was planning to go silent on July 1st. They say they don't have funds for needed equipment repairs. 1320 KSDT, Hemet, California, applies for a silent STA for financial reasons. They say they hope to return with a new city of license of Redlands if their requested CP is granted. 1390 WFHT, Avon Park, Florida, is off the air. 1400 WJWF, Columbus, Mississippi, applies for a silent STA. They've been off since April 30th with transmitter issues. 1440 WCDL, Carbondale, Pennsylvania, applies for silent STA. They've been off the air since May 17th, but do plan to return. They're building a new tower site. 1450 WKAL, Rome, New York, applies for a silent STA, having been off the air since May 8th due to satellite reception problems, a complaint of interference, and stolen copper strapping on their tower. 1510 WBSG, La Paz, Puerto Rico, applies for silent STA. They've been silent since June 4th with technical problems. 1530 WLWB, New Holstein, Wisconsin, applies for silent STA. They've been off since June 13th to put up a new tower. And 1550 WUTI, Utica, New York, station filed silent notification June 4th. These stations are staying silent. 1330 KVOL, Lafayette, Louisiana. They've been off since April 24th. KUKU, Willow Springs, Missouri, has been silent since March 1st. 1450 WBVA, Bayside, Virginia, off since April 2nd. 1550 WAZX, Smyrna, Georgia. They've been granted an extension of their silent STA, having been off the air since last September. WVAB, Virginia Beach, Virginia, granted silent STA. They've been silent since April 8th. These stations are returning to the air. 1130 WALQ, Carville, Alabama, back on as of June 18th. 1160 WIWA, St. Cloud, Florida, silent station returning to the air as of June 5th. 1230 WLNR, Kinston, North Carolina, back on with reduced power in May and full power around June 3rd. 1260 KBSZ, Apache Junction, Arizona, was silent last year, but has now been removed from the FCC silent list. Here's a new category, license reinstatements. 840 WHGH in Thomasville, Georgia. This station, silent since December 2012, has had its call letters undeleted as it's filed an application for license renewal that the FCC will now consider. 1450 WCOX, Camden, Alabama. Their license was canceled after the station failed to file for renewal by the December 1st, 2011 deadline, and the old license expired last April. But June 6th, the station was granted an STA to resume broadcasting for 6 months while its renewal application is considered. And some Canadian news via Dan Siss, Sean Axelrod, and the World Radio TV Handbook. On 850, the new station in Montreal has been granted a CP for U4, 50,000 watts day and 22,000 watts at night. Co-owned with an English talk station on 600 and French talker on 940, the stations are due to launch this fall. 1570, CKMW, Winkler, Manitoba, moving to 88.9 FM. The AM will be off the air within 90 days. Thanks to Bruce Cotty, Glenn Hauser, Steve Kennedy, Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, and Wayne Heinen. I'm Dave Alpert. Now here's Mark Durenberger.
Thank you, Dave, and hi, everyone. As some of you are listening to us at home, many of you are with us in person at the Joint DX Convention in Minneapolis. That brought to mind another recent convention, the Omaha Get-Together of 2011, where I was honored to provide the after-banquet remarks. We shared the first part of those comments back in October of 2011 on the Bandscan. Today, while we're busy in Minneapolis, here's the recording of the second part of those comments, having to do with radio during World War I and World War II, with a couple of surprise voices at the end.
Now we get to the subject of the program, and we'll speak in the lexicon of the day, DXing the war. And my premise was that if you had an infinitely wideband receiver and a super sensitive antenna, you probably could have heard an awful lot of the traffic that went down between the beginning of World War I and the end of World War II. Almost all traffic before World War I was long-distance private messaging between countries, between businesses. It was shore-based international Morse code, and it was used for ships for safety. The entire band at the start of World War I was low frequency or very low frequency, 30 to 300 kilohertz, kilocycles, and some medium, 300 to 3,000 kilocycles. At the time, short wave was considered to be 1,000 kilocycles and above. In the VLF band, well, spreading across all the bands, in fact, the spark gap stuff was being used. Tuning was just being developed. Communications were pretty much all CW, although it sort of brings to mind a soldier in a trench on a battlefield, and he's sitting there pounding a key to try to get through to somebody. That doesn't seem terribly practical when somebody's shooting at you to have a telegraph key strapped to your knee, but that's how they did it, because the landlines were getting cut by the enemy. The real military use of radio was by the land-based intercept stations. These would be big investments. The information that was gathered there had to be relayed to the troops. So if in Britain an intercept station heard that there were airplanes coming, they had to get that information to the front lines. Well, there was no short-range tactical radio equipment. They had no choice but to either rebroadcast it so that it could be intercepted or do it by landline. And as soon as war began, 1914, the British began cutting every German telephone cable they could reach, including the undersea cables. And this forced Germany to take to the airwaves. But they didn't have the trained personnel to be radio operators. And by the way, I think you all know that during World War I, all amateur radio activity had to cease. In fact, you had to dismantle your sets. I think they were worried about spies. In fact, in World War II, the same laws were passed by the United States Congress, but one exception, the ARRL sponsored, the WERS. It was an emergency communication system that used strictly for that, and that was the only thing that hams were allowed to participate in. I mentioned that the combatants, both the Allies and the Germans, had a lack of trained operators, especially at sea. So the British Marconi Company was pressed into service to train operators for shipboard assignments. A lot of them were the dispossessed ham radio operators. With the German phone lines cut on the western battlefields, the German army got itself in trouble. Their radio procedures were terrible. They never heard of net control, and they stepped on each other, passed information in the clear, and were thus a great target for interception. Early in the war came the idea of direction finding. Two or more receivers pinpointing signals defined the word triangulation. This wasn't the direction finding with a loop, this was the physical direction finding. And no one knew a lot about propagation at the time. The Germans thought, for example, that, hell, by reducing transmitter power as low as possible, they won't hear us. Well, they didn't know that about that same time, the around 1917, the British got their hands on a new RF amplifier tube that dramatically increased receiver sensitivity. German U-boat wireless sets, also not very good. They had a limited range. They had to trail a long wire antenna behind the sub. And as a result, command and control really suffered. They had a hell of a time controlling the subs in World War I, and probably the most famous example of a sub that got out of control was the one that sank the Lusitania. So now we had signal interception and direction finding as tools of war. Zeppelins raiding Britain used land-based radio signals as a navigational aid, and British and French stations would jam those signals by dropping right on top of the same frequencies. And then it was discovered that the German air crews were using transmissions from the Eiffel Tower to provide fixes. So in October of 1917, during a major Zeppelin raid on Britain, where 15, 20 of these things were coming across, they turned off the Eiffel Tower and switched on a signal from somewhere else. Same frequency, same modulation, same program. And of course, that screwed up the Zeppelin operators. They lost, I don't know, 7 or 8 of these things to the British. Some of them ended up in the south of France. So that worked. In the U.S., the U.S. Navy had taken control of radio development beginning in about 1912 after the Titanic disaster, and then until Herbert Hoover took over in the 1920s. And all of the technical development, because amateur radio, again, was forbidden, was taking places in inventors' garages, or maybe in basements or secretly funded labs. But there was some progress. One of the things that the Americans brought to the Army for France was called a goniometer. And that's today that's pretty common piece of equipment, but it's used for medical purposes. It was like a loop, but it also could describe the angle of a signal. And then by 1918, so-called portable wireless sets were in use in the front lines. They were big packs on maybe 3 mules. One would be a battery pack, and one would be the transmitter, and one would be the receiver. And if one of the mules got ahead of the other, the cables would snap. But that's how they transmitted mobile. And by the end of the war, technologists had learned that so-called short waves were better suited for tactical communications, close-in stuff. They also were able then to develop relatively small radios with power of as little as 5 watts for close-in. FM wasn't around, of course, then, but beamed antenna arrays were coming into use. Long wave was being relegated to mass broadcasting, and higher frequencies up into the VHF band were being tested. The shorter wavelengths, of course, were causing them to move into smaller and smaller sets. The British began sharpening their tools by intercepting long-wave encoded Morse code from Russia with the weather forecast. Now, that may seem trivial, except that when the weather's coming from Russia, it's not only a tactical advantage to know it, but they've learned the Russian fists. They get to know where the stations are. So that's how they practiced. So as World War II began, the Germans found that all their wires were cut again, and the Wehrmacht had to finally take to air, and they did a very good job of that. They practiced extreme radio silence. Only the Air Force, Goering's Luftwaffe, was lax about radio discipline. The British also had a lot of ground stations with direction finding, so they were able to intercept these stations' communications from the ground to the air and from the air to air. And there was no control. There was no network. There was no group leader talking to the different airplanes. There were a couple of cool things that happened. There was something called Meacon versus Beacon. The Germans, I think I mentioned, were using ground beacons for navigation. The British got pretty good at picking up that signal, re-radiating it, on another tower, same frequency, mind you, and not that far away, but their antennas got good enough so that they could pull that weak signal in and reamplify it and put it right back out 2,000 miles away from the original tower. Lots of German crashes. For control of bomber positions, World War II, the Germans had something called X-Great. It used a primary high-power director beam aimed from a specific tower at a target on a specific azimuth, and then three more beams were pointed at the target, three different directions. And where the beams intersected was the target, so you could fly that at night by radio. The place they picked was Coventry. And some of you who remember your British history know that Coventry was totally destroyed one night by 466 bombers, I think it was. All flew to the exact spot because of this radio beam. The U.S. had developed the four-course beacon. Most of us know what that is, the IFF, where you have the A and the N. The interesting thing was that it was a matter of education more than anything else out there, because 100 and 110 kilohertz receivers were pretty easy to get, but to train the pilots was tough. And I think that's why Amelia Earhart lost her life in the Pacific. She was on the director beam, but passed the station. The most remarkable counterintelligence during the war was the creation of Aspidistra. Aspidistra was British. It was an AM medium wave transmitter, 600 kilowatts. It had been built by RCA in this country for WJZ in New Jersey. They thought they were going to go to superpower after WLW had done it. And then when the FCC said, sorry, 50 kilowatts max, RCA was trying to get rid of this thing, and so they sold it to the British. And the British ran it at its full rated power of 600 kilowatts. The thing about Aspidistra is that it was used as counterintelligence. They didn't need another radio station. They needed an agile radio station. And this thing could be retuned on the fly. Some of you know the name Jonathan Marks. Here he is talking about Aspidistra. Listen to this clever application.
Because a radio transmitter can be used as a navigational aid, it wasn't surprising that when Allied bombers got within 50 miles of a German broadcast transmitter, it was taken off the air. The British decided to take advantage of the dead air to put out confusing messages. The British Air Ministry would advise the secret broadcasting complex in Milton Bryant that the target that night was Hamburg. Two radios at Milton Bryant were then set up to monitor two different regional German transmitters, one broadcasting from Cologne, let's say, and the other coming from Hamburg. A beat frequency oscillator on the radio tuned to Hamburg's channel was then switched in, giving a steady tone.
Ein im Atlantik operierender deutscher Flottenverband unter Führung des Flottenchefs.
Two telephone lines from the radios at Milton Bryant fed the output to the Aspidistra transmitter site at Crowborough. The giant medium-wave transmitter was tuned to Hamburg's frequency, but put into an automatic standby mode. When the Hamburg transmitter went off the air because of the Allied bombers, the tone generated by the Milton Bryant radio stopped, and Aspidistra came on the air instead of Hamburg, with the German program being picked up by the British from Cologne. Now that people in northern Germany thought they were still listening to the Hamburg transmitter, the propagandists could make a few special announcements.
So, with that information and that transmitter, Delmer's boys would go in carrying on with announcements exactly in the same way, because they trained for this, and they were all German-speaking, of course. They would then give instructions to the public, say that everybody should move to so-and-so, and the people should not do this, should not do that, and so on, quite a lot of instructions. And then after perhaps 5 minutes, no more, we would go off the air completely, and then the bombers would come. And of course, people in Hamburg at that time would be convinced that they were given proper and authoritative instructions.
Well, now, is that cool? There are books. I don't know what time it is, but I probably should quit pretty soon. There are thousands of books written about communications during the wars. The only other one that I think is kind of interesting is there was something called Huff Duff used on shipboard back in the war, and it was high-frequency direction finding. The Navy, particularly in the battles of the Atlantic, made a lot of changes that really worked for them. One of the things they did was their talk between ships system, which used to literally be semaphores, flags, and lights. They finally built something that worked up around 30 megs in what they called the ultra short wave band. Problem was, they didn't realize that was not line of sight, and that stuff was getting heard 1,000 miles away. But they had a semi-automated alerting system on 2410 kilohertz, kilocycles. This was the alert frequency when anyone spotted a submarine. So at that frequency, with the propagation being what it was, it certainly alerted everybody in the convoy, and from there they would go into the maneuvering mode. How did they keep in touch with shore, depending on where they were? They can't give position reports because those would be intercepted, but they had to get information from shore. So, when they were west of 32 degrees west longitude, escort ships would listen to an L broadcast from Halifax, Nova Scotia on 105 kilocycles. If they were east of 32 degrees, they listened on 107 kilocycles to a broadcast from Whitehall. A BN was the signal. So, we haven't talked about the war in the Pacific. I guess that's not a big deal tonight because it is getting kind of late. And I really appreciate your staying awake. And here we are at the end of another convention. I hope I don't have the last word, because Ernie, you should have it. This has been just a terrific show, and I really appreciate meeting so many of you. Thanks again to Ernie and Carl. Next time we meet, we'll probably still be exchanging stories about how it's getting tougher to DX the medium wave band with the so-called cheaters, and the fact that the FCC continues to fill in any open space with 1-watt signals. It's happening with FM, of course, as well. But fortunately, the DX tools are getting a little bit better too, aren't they? Unfortunately, at a time when most of us don't have a lot of disposable income, there are some really neat toys out there. And they're making reception almost painless, which is not fair either. If there's no pain involved, you shouldn't get the reward of the catch. So that's my reflection. Thank you so much, and thanks again. And it was so good to meet all of you. Take care.
Did I put you on the spot?
Right here?
You did a story.
Watch it, folks.
Yes, 4 or 5 years ago, about how KFAB and WBBM give the programming without an echo. You remember a little bit about that?
Yeah, I remember a lot.
Could you make a short
talk
on that?
The reason I remember it is it was such a kludge. Working backward, as we found out when we were out at KFAB, they were on 780 and 770, and so was WBBM in Chicago. CBS, in its wisdom, decided that if they could somehow synchronize the sound on WBBM 780 Chicago and I think it was KFAB back then, 780 Lincoln at the time, that they could actually have this homogeneous Western-sounding voice. Well, this was all very good, but the problem was in the delay of the audio. They worked out the oscillator so that everything was master oscillator, two signals. That part was easy. But getting the audio from Chicago to Lincoln so that it appeared at the Lincoln transmitter at the same time it appeared on the air in Chicago was the real issue. Because if there's a delay, they're going to fight each other. You're going to get an echo. So now, if you're with me, where do I need to put the delay?
Chicago.
Chicago. Because it's going to take a while to get to Lincoln. They made the delay out of a wall of telephone coils. A delay line made out of telephone coils. Before they did that, they built a delay out of a lead pipe. They put a microphone on one end and a speaker on the other end, and they calculated how long the sound would take to go from this end to that end in air. And they trimmed this thing until it was the exact length of the delay they needed. Can you imagine what that sounded like? It had to be just horrid. Nowadays, of course, you can get pretty close with digital delay, but it's not a practical thing to do because the only place two amplitude modulated signals will be exactly in phase is at one spot. Move 3 feet that way, it's gone. Weather changes, sky wave bumps into it, it's gone. So it really can't be done. You can approximate, but CBS should never be forgiven for what that must have sounded like in Chicago. The good audio was in Lincoln. Mike.
We had a talk radio station in Miami that had a delay system. I'll never forget this. It was run on two cartridges. And sometimes the cartridges were not clean. You
right.
hear the person with, you hear dead spots coming
yep.
up to you during the conversation, and it would fade in and fade out kind of.
That was very common back then. You'd used a single cartridge and a record play. Cart machines normally weren't made to do that, but if you modified one, it would record. I forget how it works. You put the playhead ahead of the record head, I think, something like that. But so it just continually erases itself.
Yeah.
You had to splice the tape of exactly 7 seconds length. At 7.5 inches per second, that's 49, 50, and if you got it wrong, of course, the time was off. But they lasted about a day. And then it's exactly like you said. Pretty soon they don't erase, or the heads get dirty, and you start hearing the previous pass. And then the one before that, and then the one before that. So thanks, Mike. Appreciate I'm getting the sense, I guess you all know there's a survey in the system if it's not out already. You should have it very shortly if you're with DXAS. But I'm getting the sense from what we're told that these profiles, the state of the station things, seem to be working. And those of you who are members of the DX Audio Service, you know, this is a good chance to tell me if that's not true. That if we go into a market like that and talk about it, do that every other month. Fred, with the magazine, is trying to make sure that we now get into more news and views, more receiver descriptions and tests, reviews, if you will, by qualified people, not just people who have an opinion. We're always looking for more input, but Fred has just gone, as you guys know, he puts 30 to 40 hours a month into this thing. And he's available to anybody that calls him. And so we keep trying to make it better.
So keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mark. Thank you, Ernie. Oh.
Thanks, Ernie, for a great 2011 convention in Omaha. And thank you for allowing me to be part of it. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, back to work next month with a convention report from Minneapolis and more from the DX Audio Service. Until then, good listening, DXers.
And the shuffling madness.
John Dillon, the voice of classic rock in Dallas when it was still underground, is out at KZPS. This story is by Robert Wolanski of the Dallas News. John Dillon's career in Dallas radio dates back to 1969 when he was, for a while, the sole voice of KFAD-FM, which briefly poked its head out of the rock and roll underground from 94.9 on your FM dial. After that came his stint at KRLD-AM and its FM counterpart, where he could be heard playing progressive rock all the way down to Mexico. Then in 73, he began his legendary stint at KZEW-FM, one of the first zoo freaks hired and one of the last to leave 14 years later. In 1989, he landed the midday spot at KZPS-FM 92.5, where he's been ever since. But KZPS confirms today with the radio board's whisper. John Dillon, the 2 to 7 p.m. voice of the classic rock station and a member of the Texas Radio Hall of Honor, is no longer employed by Clear Channel. Sources say Dylan, who's in his early 60s, was let go. They do not say why. Messages have been left for Clear Channel's Dallas market manager Kelly Kibler. Station program director Don Davis will only confirm Dylan's departure, but says via email that's the only comment he can offer. We've also tried repeatedly to reach Dylan, whose voice, for those of us born and raised before Led Zeppelin released its first record, is synonymous with rock and roll radio. There was no one who was that cool and who retained that cool like John Dylan, says author Joe Nick Petoskey, a jock before he picked up a pen. He was the guy I wanted to be when I worked at KFAD because he was successful. John was the guy who more than anyone brought progressive rock to the media market. He was throwing down this new music in a way most of the listening audience had never heard before. Before Redbeard, there was Dylan, and there remains Dylan to this very day. Think about that. Mike Reiner, the KTCK hardliner and one-time KZEW morning man alongside LaBella and Rhody, would agree. After all, says Reiner, there may have been some popular jocks at the zoo over the years, but John was there well before us, working the 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. shift 40 years ago. He's a pioneer, says Reiner, of the man whose interview with Freddie King was blessedly preserved for posterity. He was one of the guys who was there when hippies first started trying to convince guys who ran radio stations there was a market out there for this. He's a ground floor figure, and if he is capable of being on the air and wants to be on the air, then the fact that there's not a place for him on the air makes this a sad day. The News' late great Al Brumley profiled Dylan back in 2002, and at the time, he didn't have a single harsh word for Clear Channel. As Al noted, you don't survive in local radio that long by biting the hand that feeds you. Besides, said Dylan, his new bosses were far better than the old bosses at 92.5. When asked how long he expected to stay, Dylan told Al, "Till they drag me out of here, because it's still fun for me." Guess they dragged him out. We'll find out if and when someone calls back. But, says Petoskey, for John's voice not to be on the air is a tragedy for one of the most storied radio markets in America. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Phil Wayne.
Now, the news from the Voice of America. Israeli leader talks about peace talks with the Palestinians. Baghdad cleans up after deadly bombings. I'm Christopher Cruz, reporting live from the VOA News Center in Washington.
Taxpayer money at work. U.S.-funded foreign broadcasts finally available in the United States. This story is by Elizabeth Chuck, staff writer for NBC News. News consumers in the United States can now hear and watch reports from one of the largest broadcast groups in the world, after decades of their taxpayer dollars funding them. The change is due to a law, which went into effect July the 2nd, that authorized an independent network of U.S. government-supported broadcasters called the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the BBG, to transmit their programs. That includes the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the Mideast Broadcasting Networks, Radio Free Asia, and Office of Cuba Broadcasting to U.S. households. BBG's mission, according to its website, is to inform, engage, and connect people around the world in support of freedom and democracy. Its budget for the 2012 fiscal year, fully funded by taxpayers, was $752.7 million, according to a spokeswoman. But since 1948, BBG has only been allowed to disseminate its material to foreign listeners. This is due to a law called the Smith-Mund Act, passed 3 years after World War II. The purpose of the Smith-Mund Act, also called the United States Information and Educational Exchange Act of 1948, was to promote a better understanding of the United States in other countries, and to increase the mutual understanding between the people of the United States and the people of other countries. The law was first challenged in 1972 when J. William Fulbright, Democrat from Arkansas, declared the United States was funding propaganda and argued the Voice of America, BBG's oldest and biggest network, should be given the opportunity to take its rightful place in the graveyard of Cold War relics. Further restrictions on the dissemination of material were then implemented. The domestic dissemination ban was not really intended to protect the American public from propaganda. Emily Metzger, a professor at Indiana University School of Journalism and a former U.S. diplomat who supports the change to the law, said, "The historic record suggests that it's really more about protecting the nascent broadcasting industry in the United States right after World War II. And it was over time that more and more politics got interjected into the discussion." Last year, two lawmakers proposed the bipartisan Smith-Mund Modernization Act of 2012. Introduced by Representative Mac Thornberry, a Republican from Texas, and Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington, the Modernization Act amends the 1948 Smith-Mund Act so BBG's U.S.-funded foreign audience-intended broadcasts could finally be heard in the United States. It became law on July the 2nd. A spokeswoman for BBG pointed out that the broadcast group's content has been available online for years, and that the new law just makes their programs accessible in broadcast quality to the United States or anyone who requests them. She also responded to a slew of recent news headlines that suggested BBG would spread propaganda, including one from Foreign Policy magazine, which read, "United States repeals propaganda ban, spreads government-made news to Americans." Just because a news organization receives government funding does not mean it disseminates propaganda, Lynn Well, a director of communications and external affairs for the BBG, said, citing BBC as a government-supported media outlet. Metzger, a former U.S. diplomat, was relaxed about the change. "Everyone who is consuming any news at all should be media literate, reading from a wide range of sources, triangulating what they can about the truth. In that sense, I'm not particularly alarmed about the government having a new path to propagandize the public," she said. A State Department official said in an email statement to NBC News that "the statutory intent remains for us to focus such materials on foreign audiences and not to go proactively to create materials for a domestic audience or proactively distribute our materials domestically." BBG's journalists risk their lives to report in more than 100 countries and 61 languages, Well said. "This is good quality reporting in places where many United States media may not have correspondents. Why shouldn't it be available in the United States?" she said. "U.S. taxpayers should know what they're funding." Ted Lapine, a former Voice of America employee based in California who retired from the network in 2006, said his biggest concern about BBG expanding into the American market was the quality of their journalism diminishing. "The agency has been very badly mismanaged in recent years," he said. "What I suspect will happen is that they will de-emphasize providing news and information for foreign audiences, which is the core and primary reason, and they will focus on domestic markets. We'll deny that that will be an issue. The target audience for BBG broadcasts will still be international. That is, individuals living in countries where the media is not entirely free. The new law does not change the legislation that mandates the BBG to focus on audiences overseas, nor are we seeking to change that," she said. "It also does not direct or allow the BBG itself to begin broadcasting in the United States, and we do not seek that either. But the new law does mean that an entire range of great journalism that U.S. taxpayer-supported civilian broadcasters produce now can now be seen and heard by more people, including the ones who pay for it, she said. And that story was Taxpayers' Money at Work, U.S.-funded foreign broadcasts finally available in the United States from NBC news writer Elizabeth Chuck.
That's the news at this hour from the Voice of America. You can find more on these and other stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Pakistan envoy seeks to ease tensions with Afghanistan. Japan's ruling coalition wins parliamentary election. Decorated U.S. aviator returns to North Korea in search of fellow pilot's remains. These stories and more in this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia.
The National Radio Club Antenna Pattern Book, 7th edition, is now shipping. This all-new edition prepared by NRC'er Paul Swearingen is an all-inclusive book of patterns for both day and night operation of stations in the USA, Canada, and selected foreign stations. The data for the book comes from the forthcoming 34th edition of the AM Radio Log and NRC'er John Collerman's comprehensive Mexican station listing. The book comes shrink-wrapped in 8.5x11 three-hole punch format for placement in your own three-ring binder. There are 240 pages, and the book has maps covering 530 through 1700 kilohertz, depicting the lower USA, Canada, and Mexico. Hawaii and Alaska are shown on separate maps at the end of the book. The book is available from the National Radio Club at P.O. Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047, and ships via Media Rate to addresses in the United States for $22.95 for members and $28.95 for non-members. You can add $3.85 for priority mail. Canadian orders are $35, and all other countries are $39. Both are shipped global priority mail. The book is also available from our website using PayPal, www.nrcdxas.org. So hopefully you'll be picking up your copy soon. 7-3, it's Wayne Heinen.
And now, a DX Audio Service editorial. Here is the chief editor of the DX Audio Service, Fred Vobey.
Americans should pay attention to what is happening to broadcast television. In 1970, there were 82 channels for United States broadcasters. But channels 70 to 83 were deleted to make room for what is now called cellular telephone. You know, those things that you carry around on your hip. TV was able to shoulder the loss of channels because there were not that many TV stations by the mid-80s. Starting in the mid-90s and ending in 2009, channels 52 to 69 were deleted. The reason Congress and the Federal Communications Commission gave for deleting channels was to give Homeland Security frequencies for emergency radio communications. However, a massive poster, made out to look like a big old check, above Reed Hunt's desk at the Federal Communications Commission stated, payable to the United States Treasury $1 billion. This referred to what the Federal Communications Commission thought that they could make by selling channels 52 to 69 to private companies. TV broadcasters struggled to adapt, as there were now many more TV stations on the air, even in small, rural towns. Very few Americans don't have access to local news, weather, sports, and emergency information via television. As of today, there have been hardly any licenses issued for Homeland Security or anything to do with public safety. The Federal Communications Commission and Congress has finally admitted the plan was to sell those channels to privately owned wireless companies for a profit. Now Congress and the Federal Communications Commission are looking to pillage TV once again. This time, they're making no bones about the fact that they want to take away TV channels to sell to private wireless companies. Channels 31 to 51 will have to move, or go off the air, or simply find a new place on the TV dial. Translators, mostly used in rural areas to relay signals, will go off the air. The bottom line is, the public will lose TV stations. The digital transition in 2009 left channels 2 through 6 unusable for digital transmission. Channels 7 to 13 are not favored in urban areas because of reception difficulties. That leaves channels 14 to 30 for TV broadcasters. 17 channels for all of the TV stations in the United States. Period. In some cities, not all the stations can move to new channels. There's just no place to go. So who stays and who goes? Who makes that choice? Most large cities face the same problem. According to a national broadcast publication, 30% of rural TV viewers will lose access to local television. Many more will lose choices in what to watch. Government solution? Well, let them watch YouTube. Well, why should you care? The answer is simple. When emergencies happen, the public turns to TV and radio for information. As proved during Katrina and numerous other disasters since then, and recently in Moore, Oklahoma, when disaster happens, the internet, cell phones, and public utilities just shut down. Broadcasters step up to the plate with factual news and information. And if, God forbid, there's a public uprising, do you think that the government would allow the internet, cell phones, Facebook, Twitter, and TV by satellite and dish to operate? What gives government the right to tell a TV station, "Sorry, we have to take your license away and your business so we can sell it to a big wireless company"? Why should they be allowed to take away your access to television, your source of news and information? Why are the public airwaves being used as a cash cow for big business? Who is getting rich or benefiting from the loss of local TV? Those of you working in radio and those of you listening to your radios should be concerned, because if it happens to broadcast television, it may very well happen to radio. Or maybe this is what someone wants. If you kill the ability of the citizens of a nation to see and hear what is going on, and you limit their ability to get news and information, you've gained a strategic leghold in controlling the masses. During China's uprising, their government limited what people could see and hear. Russia, Cuba, Argentina, Egypt, and others did the same. See a pattern? Maybe our masters learned a new trick. We need to contact our congressmen and tell them no to the TV spectrum repack. Say no to giving public TV channels to private industry for money. Leave TV and radio alone. We want our independent voices, independent news, and independent journalism. That's my opinion. Let's hear yours. This concludes part one of the DX Audio Service for August 2013. We'll see you on part two.